Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Friday Special, a podcast by Guitar Nerds. Now for 2020, the Friday Special series is running every week, and each week we'll have a new guest from the world of guitars, amplification, effects, pedals. We'll have brands, producers, musicians, etc. I'm your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by my co-host, Matt Knight.
Hello.
Hello, and our special guest, Steve Mack from the Australian Pink Floyd. Hello, Steve, and welcome to the show.
G'day there. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, wonderful.
A proper
Australian welcome. Thank you very much, Steve. Now, Steve is a founding member of the Australian Pink Floyd show. Who are the most successful and largest Pink Floyd tribute band. They've headlined, you know, festivals, toured the world relentlessly since, you know, they started in 1988. You know, reimagining and recreating large-scale Floyd-esque stadium shows and performances, and, you know, taking Dave Gilmour's role in the band, Steve has recreated and reimagined a Gilmour-style rig with incredible detail. He's an absolute messiah of real-life guitar nerds. So Steve is one of very few men that I've met who can actually rival Matt Knight's level of pedal geekery.
Yeah, and I think I think it's fair to say, and I've been talking to Steve for a couple of years now, that this is probably more of a self-indulgent episode for myself, and probably more of a learning experience for you, Joe.
Yes.
And obviously the reason I wanted to reach out to you, Steve, and get you on here is we've obviously been talking about some Boss stuff, but you sent me some pictures of your studio rig, and I was like, we kind of have to talk about it, because it is one of the most glorious things that I've ever seen, and we'll certainly post some pictures in the Facebook group as well. But for me, you know, having seen you guys play four times now, I think, you know, and every time for my family, my dad got me into Pink Floyd, I guess half the people were probably going, oh, I love hearing all these Pink Floyd tunes, and then there's the small group of us all stroking our beards going, I wonder how he got that Gilmour sound. So I guess maybe we should start by asking you, I mean, just give us a rundown of, you know, how it started, and, you know, why Pink Floyd, and
I was going to say, because it's been, you know, 1988 was the start of this. Of course, you were called Think Floyd at the time, back in Adelaide in Australia. But, you know, this is quite a journey from that to now being, you know, part of one of the most successful tribute bands in the world.
It has been an incredible journey. We started off in, obviously, clearly in 1988 in Adelaide. There was a guy there who still lives there called Lee Smith, who's a lovely guy, a wonderful friend of mine. And he was just the biggest Pink Floyd fan you could ever meet, really, and a great guitarist too. He put some ads in the local music shops, and me and Jason Sawford, the keyboard player, we responded to those and went down on a Saturday morning. Met at a schoolyard, and they had a rehearsal room there, and we just hit it off straight away. And the whole idea was to do original music, but it was also to play Pink Floyd music, just for fun, really. It was just a few mates, a few beers, get the Barbie going on a weekend, that kind of stuff. And we did it, and it kind of just fell together really quickly and easily. It was bizarre. We'd been in other bands, cover bands before, but this just had something about it. There was one of the brother-in-laws of one of the guys. It was his birthday, so we played for his birthday, and everyone that was there, there was about 30 people there, were just going crazy. And that encouraged me to go to a pub, and we got a gig at our first pub, a place called the Alma Hotel. And then that just went incredibly well, and before we knew it, I spoke to a guy called Brian Gleeson from the Adelaide Rock Exchange, who was an agent, and he got us all these works, all these gigs in different types of venues, and then an Australian tour and bigger shows, and off it went.
But off it went.
I guess this is maybe not necessarily just, or maybe you can give a bit of insight into this in general, but for me, I've always thought that being in a band in Australia must be the most difficult thing to try and start touring, because Australia is so massive, and it must have been quite a tricky thing at first to go, like, you know, at least in England you can drive from one end to the other and hit about six or seven cities on the way, but is it the same thing over there?
Well, Australia's the same size as Central America.
Yeah.
So it's massive, absolutely enormous. So we did have to do a lot of driving, and financially it was just for fun. We all put money into it. It cost us money to do it. We all had jobs, and then we'd book holidays and we'd go on these week or 2 week tours. And that's all just gigging on the weekends. That's how we did it. But we didn't make a penny out of it in Australia. It was purely just for the love of it, and it was quite expensive to do. Yeah. So we did love it an awful lot, you know.
How did you go about this? Might be sort of jumping the gun a bit, because I know we want to talk about all the things that you did and how you got from A to B. But how did you go about replicating those sort of Gilmour sounds in those early days, when, you know, you're still sort of working another job? And how accurate do you think you managed to come with much smaller rigs, I guess? Like, how did you make a Gilmour pub rig, I guess?
It was pretty difficult, because this is before eBay and the internet. And in Adelaide, you didn't really get that much information as far as what David Gilmour used. It was purely from looking at photographs in books or album covers or bootleg covers. So, and trying to get a lot of that equipment, you just couldn't get it in Australia. So you just had to make do with whatever pedals you could tweak and try and replicate that sound. And fortunately, Boss came to the rescue in the early days. And I'm not just saying that because Matt's here, but it really was the saving grace. We didn't have any boutique pedals. We didn't have really electroharmonics pedals, or it was Boss and Ibanez, really, back in those days. Was all we really had. Or sounds in amps, you know, and then multi-effects came kind of later on from that, but it was just the odd stomp pedals. I remember building, I worked for a company called Telecom Australia, and I used a whole load of rack telephone equipment, test equipment, and I took the innards out of all my Boss pedals and fit it inside these racks and built like a Bradshaw / Cornish version of a multi-effects unit.
Most people can remember their first pedal board, which is generally a bit of wood on the floor. Taking it to the next level.
But yeah, so I did that, and I remember my boss coming into the workshop and telling me off, because my lunch break ended up being 3 hours because I'd be building it and getting carried away. But in the end, my bosses were very big fans of the band and wished us all the best. But there was a lot of homemade stuff. We just had to improvise, and of course, then you just sit there and listen to the records and just tweak for days, always trying to improve it, get it better.
Yeah, I guess what's bizarre, and it's something that we definitely, you know, you take for granted now, but, you know, unless you read a magazine, and a magazine had specifically gone and sought out exactly what someone was using, it wasn't exactly like there's the books, the resources you can get now. I mean, obviously, Gil Moorish is a fantastic resource for everything David Gilmour, but, I mean, then it was just like, and I'm sure half of those pedals, especially the stuff he used in the 60s, probably didn't even exist really in that much capacity 20 years on. They've probably all been outdated by that point.
I mean, very much so. When we first came to England, I think it was 94, I actually went down and visited Pete Cornish's workshop, and he started... I spent the day there, got a hotel, and went back the following day. He was brilliant, him and Linda, really, really, really informative. And he was showing me all the different effects and telling me how the different circuits worked and what was going on. And he told me about the, I don't know if you know the song called Echoes, and there's like a whale song in the middle. Some people call it like a seagull sound.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It was an embryo as well, but that's just a wah pedal wired in reverse.
But yes,
I didn't know that, and that you couldn't find anything. There's never anything in a magazine or a book or anywhere that told people how he got that sound. And it wasn't till years after I came to England that I discovered what it was. Where is that today? A 15-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid can get online and bang, they've got everything they need. And if their dad's well off, they can get on eBay and they can buy it and pretty much have.
Yeah, I mean, so just quickly, just on that point, then. Firstly, Embryo is probably one of my favourite, like, unreleased Pink Floyd songs, because it never made it. I don't think it actually made it to an album, but it was on a couple of their recent box sets. But how did you go about doing that before you knew what was in those bits in the songs?
I just used like a slide.
Right, okay.
Slide and just played it, you know, physically played it.
Yeah, wow. With
a lot of delay and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's just mad. Like you say, now you just go, oh, yeah, it's just a wah pedal in plugged in reverse. I mean, it's amazing that people even, you know, obviously, thankfully, guys like Pete Cornish, who built the rigs, were just like, yeah, it's just, you know, it's just that. And I mean, obviously, an original mistake in the studio, but sometimes that sort of knowledge just gets lost. So in ways, I think it's great that, you know, tribute acts like yourself are still like honing in on those sounds, bringing that sort of stuff to people's attention as well.
I think they're just great sounds as well. There's Pink Floyd and David Gilmour, they all created their own universe.
Yeah.
Where they were instantly recognisable that it was them because of the Hammond sound, the bass guitar sound, all the guitar sounds, the vocal effects, the drum sound. They just had their own uniqueness. And you don't seem to get as much of that these days. I might be wrong. Perhaps I'm too old to hear it in the younger music. But I don't know. It's just... It's very hard to recreate those old sounds, I find, compared to the newer sounds.
Sure, no, I completely agree. Very difficult to replicate them, like doubly so when you don't have, you know, the resources of the internet as you didn't at the time when you started.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think actually as well, now there's almost too much choice. I mean, there's 50 tone benders, you know, there's hundreds of different Big Muff clones. You know, loads of people trying to make pedals that recreate that sound, and you can really fall down that sort of rabbit hole.
Oh yeah.
But I was saying to Joe before you joined us, Steve, that to me David Gilmour always stuck out, and I think still does, as one of the guitar players of that generation, but even now, that was very gear heavy. You know, a lot of other players, I mean, you think of like Jeff Beck or you think of Jimmy Page, those guys always, you know, it's, oh, it's Les Paul and a Marshall, or it's, you know, it's a Strat and a wah pedal or whatever.
Of the sort of classic, like those like top 10, you know, guitar players, the people that always make that list, he's probably the only one with like a sizable pedal board, you know, the only one who's really effects driven.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's people like The Edge who has a phenomenally large rig, but again, guitar wise, what he actually plays is quite simple, isn't it?
Yeah,
very simplistic. It's all about delays and stuff, but it's very effective and it sounds instantly like him.
Yeah, that's true.
When he does it, but the thing is with David Gilmour, when they first started out, it kind of was just a fuzz face and a hot high watt,
yeah,
and a Strat, you know. So he did start off quite minimalistic, and then it just kind of, as the success came,
yeah,
it just grew, didn't it? It just,
yeah, absolutely. So I guess that kind of then, you know, if we kind of say, you know, you've been in the band a couple of years, you know, you've got more gigs, you're starting to do some bigger shows, like where did you kind of start with the sort of rig journey, when it became more serious, or when you went, right, this is my full-time job, like what was your leaping off point?
It's a long story, but to cut it short, I had to come to England for a funeral, and while I was here, I went to London and tried to speak to Harvey Goldsmith to try and get some interest. He told me to bugger off, pretty much. And so I phoned Glenn Povey from Brain Damage magazine, and I met up with him, and coincidentally he was putting on a big Pink Floyd fan convention show at Wembley the following year, and he was looking for a band, so we just happened to cross paths at the right time and he booked us, and then off we came. So I went back to Australia, told the lads, and we were like, right, okay, we've really got to up our game now. So that's kind of when we started to build stuff, and we had this idea of building everything in its own boxes. So all of the guitar amps and the Hammond organ, the Leslie speaker, sorry, they were all encased in their own flight case with microphones on them to make them soundproof. And we traveled with them, but it did give you that constant sound because it was isolated. It was always the same. And we rented a house, and nine of us would go in this house, including our crew, and we'd just rehearse 8 hours a day, about 6 days a week. And we just honed it then, and we worked on all the sounds, all the arrangements, the set, just everything. And then we packed all that up, like this whole studio, and we flew it out to England to come and do this Wembley convention show. And we turned up at Heathrow. They wouldn't let me in because I didn't understand about visas. So after a lot of arguments, my uncle, who was living in England, had to vouch for me and promise that if I couldn't afford to pay my way, he'd sponsor me. So that was one thing we got through, and then we went to pick up all of our equipment and they wouldn't give it to us because we didn't have a car, and they were just like, no, sorry, you can't, you're not allowed to bring it in the country. And I'll never forget, there was a lovely Indian chap who was ever so helpful. He loved Pink Floyd. We told him what we were doing. He gave us all these forms and said, take these away, change all these figures, write this on it, come back, and we'll be able to sign it off and release your equipment. So it was quite an adventure, and we didn't have a clue what we were doing.
Wow.
We were just these country bunking, wet behind the ear, Adelaide Australian lads. And we just, every step of the way, it was, you know, a struggle and adventure, but I guess we were just too determined to stop. you know, or, yeah. or too silly, too stupid.
Well, I guess it paid off in the end. And we'll definitely come to some of the bigger gigs, you know, a bit later on. So what was the kind of rig at that point? Can you remember what you were sort of using?
Yeah, I had two Fender Twin reverbs, silver face jobs. Lee had those as well. So they were built into one box back to back. Lee had the same. Pedals wise, compression, I was using Ibanez compression. I didn't have any Boss stuff. Lee had Boss compressors. I was using the Ibanez. And then I had an overdrive pedal, Boss OD1, PH1. I think it was a CE2. It was like a super chorus.
I mean, oh, yeah,
going
the
back
CH1.
27 years now. yeah, delays. We had it. We both used this Yamaha R100, I think it was called, which was like a digital delay reverb. We had both had a mixing desk. Everything went into that. We blended DI guitar signals with the microphones in the cabinets. Yeah, it was just some EQ. Remember, we had these Stereo Alesis 31-band graphic EQs that we used just to kind of tailor the sound to make the DI sound more ampish. You know, basically, the very, you know, sort of poor man's amp sim back in those days. And that was kind of it for a couple of years. And then I discovered an Art SGX 2000.
Yes. Which, I mean, was that a rack unit?
It was a rack unit with a valve. It's got a valve and like a valve preamp. And that was a game changer because not only did it have all the sounds and programmable for because obviously you use that many sounds to recreate a Pink Floyd set, you know, of 3 hours of music. There's a lot of different sounds in there. So the fact that you could program them all in, as everyone just takes it for granted now, but this was quite groundbreaking at the time. The good thing about it was that it became the heart of the system because it had so many ins and outs and loops and effect returns and different outputs, different types of outputs to send to the amps and to send to DIs. So it had a lot of versatility and it kind of worked well with a mixing desk to give you more of a portable studio again, which has always been the approach we've taken, is to try and take a studio on the road that's roadworthy, to try and get as the most versatility you can out of your equipment on stage.
Yeah. And then I guess, yeah, maybe a lot of boutique stuff, or what we would class as boutique, maybe really hadn't entered the sort of fray yet. So it's, you know, a lot of that earlier rack stuff, that 90s rack stuff, was really, really groundbreaking.
Yeah, and consistent. You know, if you had one, if it went faulty, you'd bought another one, you stick it in, and it sounded the same. Whereas, as you know, with pedals, the older they get, especially some of the rare ones, they've all been worked on and repaired. They all sound different, and you can buy 10 off of eBay, and not one of them sounds how you want it or the same. You know, so just because someone says, "Oh, David Gilmour used this pedal," doesn't mean that if you buy it, it's going to sound anything like his. You know, so
is that something that you've taken kind of across the board, approaching the sort of tones that you want to? I appreciate at the moment we're still talking about the early days, but is that something you still find now, that it's not so much about replicating everything like for like, it's more of a I guess a tonal thing rather than an equipment thing, and you're finding the gear that works for you to create that sound?
Yes, to some degree. There's obviously some equipment that you have to buy that particular unit, and some of that equipment, like the Cornish stuff, it does all sound the same. You know, it's not, you're not going to get two P1s that sound very different. You know, they're very all identical because he's so precise and accurate and true to the design. But as far as a lot of stuff, there are equipment out there. Well, there is equipment and pedals out there that do sound like how you want it, more so than what if you buy a second hand original of that pedal. There's pedals out there that kind of do a better job of sounding like how David Gilmour sounded on the record back in the day.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, because I guess your approach, and this is something that, you know, I always feel, you know, especially having seen you guys, is, you know, you think about the early, or you listen to the early Pink Floyd live performances, and you can listen to them on box sets and stuff. And obviously there was a big element of improvisation. And obviously when they moved into things like Dark Side of the Moon, obviously they were doing the record in full. But it was still very much, you know, they were doing their own thing. And I guess what you're trying to do is actually recreate the sound on the record.
Yes.
Is that sort of fair to say that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's always been our mandate, really. Whereas Pink Floyd, as you probably well know, they would take the album on the road and tour it for 2 years before they recorded it. So every performance could have been different and using different equipment to experiment with. And then when they were really happy with it, they went and recorded it.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't really work like that anymore. People record the albums and then they'll go and tour with it. Because obviously everyone would just bootleg it anyway before they record it.
So the next question I kind of had was, so obviously, you know, 88, for those who aren't obviously massive Pink Floyd fans, but maybe know a bit about them, obviously 88 was a year after Momentary Lapse of Reason, I think. So then they didn't have another album until The Division Bell, right, which was 94?
Yes.
Was it 94?
I think it was 94 or 95.
I didn't realise it was that late.
So I guess you were obviously sort of fairly well established at that point, and then all of a sudden they come along with a new record. Like, two questions. One, how did you sort of keep up, and how long did you have to listen to the record for to work out all the tunes on it?
Well, quite a lot, really. Well, obviously study and, you know, sort of analysing it, stripping it down, and then working on those sounds. But the fortunate thing for us was that when we finally came to England and left our lives in Australia, this became a full-time job 24/7. And, you know, we didn't have that many gigs, so we had a lot of time to put that work in. Whereas if, you know, your average guitarist who's got a job and was working for a living and they're doing everything in their spare time, where we were kind of fortunate enough to be in that position where that is your full-time job. So you can knock it together reasonably quickly. Plus, we had several years of experience of doing it. So we had a bit of a, you know, head start of an idea as where to start with those tracks.
Yeah, because I think there's a really famous David Gilmour picture that I'm sure many people will know, which is, I think it was from the Division Bell tour, which is that crazy rack unit that he had behind him off stage. I think it was either Momentary Lapse of Reason or Division Bell, which is just like pedals on top, then, you know, two 21U rack units. Did you just look at that and go, oh, at least I can get a good picture of what I need to aim for?
It was, in fact, Pete Cornish actually sent me those photographs, which was really kind of him. And of course, the first thing you do is get your pedals out and put the knob settings to the same as what David Gilmour's used. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work, because buffers and all that come into play, and they really change how pedals behave and sound. And obviously, Pete Cornish has buffers before and after every single pedal. So you can't just get all those pedals, plug them in, and expect them to sound right.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
that must have been a disappointing thing in some way to kind of go, oh, I've got those, and I'll set the sounds exactly the same. And it's like, it doesn't sound anything. Because I guess that's, for me, that's, and that's the great thing about seeing you guys live, and especially you, who, you know, you've got to play like, it's not just sounding like him, you've got to have the same, you know, feel. And you're not just trying to emulate his sound, you're trying to emulate his playing style.
I definitely think the playing style is number one. That's the most important thing, because if you can play it with the right feel, your sound actually, it can be a bit more forgiving with it, because it's so much of it is in the fingers and in the mind, you know, and how you approach it, how you the feel, the emotion and stuff, the attack. Yeah, the sound is very, very important, but it's certainly not as important as you just said, the feel. That's the key to it.
Yeah.
And quite often, if you play it with the right feel, with a sound that isn't particularly that close, it still sounds very close to it. If you were to get the exact sound, but you don't play it right, it's not going to sound anything like it.
Yeah, makes sense. And for me, actually, that it kind of leads on to one thing we haven't really talked about is guitars. So for a lot of people, and obviously fairly recently when it was auctioned off, the Black Strat is the most iconic of David Gilmour's instruments. But there was a big period where it wasn't used, especially in the late 80s and going into the 90s. I always remember obviously him playing a Red Strat with the
EMGs.
The EMGs. So, you know, what was your jumping off point for that?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It's hard to you kind of go, well, I've got to have... I mean, I'm assuming it had to be a Strat, but it was like, where do you move from there?
It was eventually... I started off with an Ibanez guitar originally. The first guitar I ever bought was a Les Paul copy. And the reason I bought that was because the only photograph I'd seen of David Gilmour was of him playing a Les Paul.
Right.
So just, again, pure ignorance. Because where we lived, you just didn't get any information about Pink Floyd and all of their album covers that I had. There were no photographs on them. You know, it was all imagery and they were very mysterious. So... they didn't let anything on. But I finally got a Strat copy. It was by a Profile, it was called. Brand called Profile. It was a Japanese one. I've still got it. I've kitted that out with some EMG pickups in and out of the David Gilmour system, which is really versatile. I've got to say, it is a great setup. I can really see why he used it. It wasn't just about... noise, you know, sort of isolation to get rid of the interference and stuff because they're so quiet. But it's just the versatility you get with it is incredible. But for that particular era in Pink Floyd, that obviously it works, but if you want to sound like the albums from prior to that, then you've got to go back to single coils. We also use stack pickups, some Seymour Duncan stacks, and we usually have a second guitar, which if we have a really noisy stage with interference and stuff, then we pull that one out. You do lose a bit of that tone, bit of that top-end harmonics, but it means that you can still play without the guitar just being out of control, you know, due to noise and stuff.
And your main guitar now, which is a Strat, actually been played by David Gilmour, right?
That's true. That's true. It is his birthday. He came up, got on stage, and I knelt down before him and raised it up like... passing the sword Excalibur to King Arthur, and he took it, looked down at my pedal board and said, "So, how do you fly this thing?" I thought it was pretty cool.
I guess that's we should probably talk about just a couple of those gigs, because I mean, just reading obviously the biography on the website, you've played the Royal Albert Hall, Wembley. But for me, and the one I certainly mentioned to you, you know, last time I saw you, was the fact that you played David Gilmour's 50th birthday party.
Yeah, that was incredible, and a real honour, of course. It kind of came out the bluish, but it was also on the back of an invitation to play at Earl's Court at the end of tour party for Pink Floyd as well. But the David Gilmour's birthday, there was 500 celebrity guests, and probably the most terrifying gig of our lives. It was pretty scary, but they were all lovely. They were great, and David was really nice, really down to earth.
And it was because he'd always wanted to see Pink Floyd perform, right?
Yeah, apparently so. That was one of the things his regrets.
That's amazing. I think that's incredible. And I guess maybe just moving forward, let's just talk about obviously where you are now. So obviously you've been touring for, you know, many years and many years since Pink Floyd haven't been performing, which has obviously been a great thing that you're out there, because people like myself who are unfortunately never going to be able to see the band play, you know, you guys are out there doing it. So I guess we should talk about your guitar rig now, and certainly your home studio rig, which obviously we're on a podcast, so I'll try and just give listeners a bit of a roundup with there's two ES8s, five Morningstar loop switches controlled by a separate MIDI foot controller. There's an SY-1000 on there. We've got four, maybe five Pete Cornish pedals, some Origin pedals, Thorpey pedals, Strymon, two different EQ pedals. It is a rig that many could dream of. And I guess, you know, one, how did you find the time to plug it all in? Because there's some serious cabling going here. But just, is the rig you have at home for the studio, is that the same rig you take out on tour?
It isn't. It's similar in some ways, but different in other ways, to make it more easier in the studio to get more sounds than just Pink Floyd sounds. So, because obviously I'm venturing into my own music, and after doing this for 31 years, I just thought it's about time I started recording it again. And the rig that you've seen, I've been collecting those pedals for about 10 years for it, and this year, because of the horrid COVID-19, it's kind of presented itself with a lot more time for me to do this. So I thought, well, I have to do this now. I've really got to build it. So I just, as I get older, you start to think about your back and stuff. And I thought, well, rather than have it on the floor, I'm going to have it so it's waist high, and try and just make it so it's very easy to access and tweak and fiddle while you're actually playing to work on sounds. Whereas it's the opposite to the live rigs, which are more set and forget. You work on your sound, you got your hands in the rack and you're doing whatever you're doing, and you store everything and save it, and then you just recall that sound on stage during the gig. But there's not much knob tweaking or anything like that.
Yeah.
On stage, it's all, you know, pre-programmed and you're just accessing it via a foot pedal.
I was going to say, as a side question, I mean, how many presets do you have going?
I have 100 presets, purely because that's the maximum number that my live rigs can hold. So what happens if we do new songs that we haven't played before and I've got to delete sounds? So I've got to sort of scratch my head and think, right, what song are we not likely to play for a long time? And I'll delete them and then overwrite them with the new sounds for whatever songs we're doing. But yeah, songs like Echoes, there's 10 sounds in that one. So that's 10% of your sounds gone just for one song. Shine On, I use 6 sounds in that. Dogs and Sheep, there's several in those each. So you soon use up your memory space.
Yeah, it's funny. I've never really, I've, you know, so often, you know, we kind of mess around at home or, you know, Joe, obviously you're out playing a lot, but, you know, maybe using an MS3 and a couple of pedals, you're sort of like, oh, I've got, you know, my core 6 sounds. But of course, if you're trying to sound like a record and then you're trying to sound like 10 records.
Yeah, you've got to be so much more specific. You can't just sort of, you know, this drive sounds fine. You know,
it's like 40 or 50 years worth of sounds, you know.
Yeah.
And the really odd thing is as well with David Gilmour's sounds is that when you sculpt them and you get them so they sit in the song and they kind of work the way they do on the albums, when you actually separate them from the song and play them by themselves, they're pretty bad sounds sometimes. I know it sounds, they're gorgeous and perfect in the song, but you can't really use them much in other music, right, is what I've found. They're so perfectly tailored for that song. They don't really work in, if you were to play, I don't know, Sweet Home Alabama or Stairway to Heaven or something, and just try to rip up a solo sound out of my rig, you'd struggle to find one that really worked for it, because they're so specific for that Pink Floyd moment.
I think something across the board with Dave Gilmour's tones, they are every single tone seems to be for a very specific purpose. There's no kind of there's no, you can't get away with a general lead tone and a general drive tone for what you do. That's got to be very difficult.
It's also, they were, as musicians, especially Rick and David, they were so sympathetic to the song and to each other when it comes to like frequency real estate. So they never crowded a particular frequency range where they were wrestling with each other. They always left space. They were the perfect gentlemen when it comes to leaving room for every part of that song to be heard and to have its own place. And sometimes if you're sculpting those guitar sounds, when you put it in another song, it clashes with other instruments. So that's why they're probably so specific as well, because there's so much EQ sculpting as well that goes on.
Yeah, of course.
So how does it work in rehearsal then? If you're sort of midway through a 20-minute song and you're like, oh, these sounds aren't quite right. I mean, is it a case of just like, because like you say, they're so specifically sculpted, you know, to sit in that mix and, you know, complement the rest of the band. Like, just like you say, dialing in at home must be a very different experience than taking it into a room full of 9 other people.
It is, yeah. We obviously spend a lot of time away from rehearsals on our own, working on our own parts, and we would play along to the records, the albums, and get it so it works with that. And then we'd come together and we record ourselves. And we generally, we record ourselves all throughout the whole day, and then we'll listen to it and our individually our parts that evening, and get in there early the next day and do a few tweaks. And it's always an ongoing process. You know, you're always just working. And then we'll have pre-production. We record that. I'll listen to it. Then we'll make tweaks, speak to the front of house people. We'll make tweaks. And to this day, whenever we tour, we record every single show. And after the gigs, sad as it may be, I listen to every show in my bunk or my bed on the tour bus or whatever, and I'll make a whole lot of notes and we'll tweak and adjust things and do it again and again and again. And it's just a quest to improve upon it. And so as the year goes by and we do about 100 shows a year, it's getting tweaked and improved upon and honed. And we're never happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess it's the ultimate tone chase in some ways, isn't it? Because, you know, as we've said, it's not about necessarily the live sound. It's about the sound of the record. It's about bringing that feeling to people, the first time they heard Dark Side of the Moon or The Wall or anything like that. It's, you know, this the sound of the record they heard, not necessarily the sound of it live. I think it must be almost like someone with red light syndrome can never kind of finalize a recording, always wants another take. I guess you must always feel like I could always change that just a little bit.
It does, although the one of the real luxuries, I guess, of being in a tribute band is that you have the blueprint. The album is the blueprint. It's like the Bible. That's the decider as to what's right and what's wrong. It doesn't come down to personal opinions and taste. So it does avoid having a lot of arguments or anything between us, because if we're not sure about anything, we just pull the album out and listen to it and go, oh, yeah, you're right. That's got too much 1.6K in it, you know, or it's too dry, it's too wet, or whatever. You know, it's too loud in the mix, or it's too quiet.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we've got that sort of argument resolution system there. You just go back to the original, the blueprint, and that is correct. And that's the direction we have to take. That's the path we follow.
Yeah.
And we all get on great. And the front of house engineer, Trevor, that we use, he's just fantastic. He's a big Pink Floyd fan and he really knows it inside and out. And he's so easy to work with. And I think that's the thing about being a tribute band, because you're fans first. We're not rock stars up on a stage. We're not famous. The music is famous. We're like an orchestra playing a soundtrack to the lighting show. So it does keep you grounded as well, because we're not in the limelight. We're not getting photographs in magazines and all that because of who we are. We're just playing that music. So it's a really good atmosphere and vibe. There's about 40 of us on the road and everyone's just laid back and they're all just trying to make this the best it can be.
Well, I guess just bringing it away from gear for a little bit, for those of you who haven't seen it as well, not only is it just, you know, the best experience to listen to Pink Floyd music live, it's also one of it's an incredible light show, which is something that obviously I'm guessing has evolved considerably, for the last three decades.
Yeah, and we've got people that have been doing it for 20 years with us. So again, they video the show and look at it and they're tweaking it and always trying to improve upon it. So yeah, we're just really lucky. We've got some great people.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, I won't spoil a couple of the surprises that have appeared every time when I've seen it. I would say hopefully when all of the world returns to normal and you guys are back out on the road, because I think you were supposed to be on tour at some point this year.
Absolutely. Well, we were in France when we were told we have to come back to the UK due to the large gathering restrictions and bans they had. Fortunately, we got back because it was only days after that people were getting held up and quarantined and stuff. So we got everyone back safely. Unfortunately, no one caught anything. But yeah, that was going to run for, you know, 2.5-3 months.
Wow.
So we did 11 shows out of 101 and then came back, and it was, we're all dressed up and nowhere to go, which is a shame. But obviously the stuff that's going on in the world is awful, it's terrible, but, and you know, music isn't a necessity. And I'm certain the industry will pick up again when the important stuff of dealing with all this has been resolved.
Yeah.
You know, people can enjoy themselves.
Absolutely. So I guess I kind of wanted to round this chat off. I mean, I think we'd be here forever if you tried to explain the signal chain that's going on in some of the studio pictures.
I think there's a series in this. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I said to you, you need to get in on the Facebook group. We'll post a couple of these pictures, and then we'll let people ask questions out of just cable length. How many miles of cable must you be using? So I kind of just wanted to go two questions, really. What are your five favorite pedals that you're kind of using right now?
Five pedals to nail the Gilmore sound.
And yeah, and then maybe five pedals that you have to have if you're going to go down the Gilmore route.
Okay. I'd say...
Putting you on the spot there a little bit.
Color Sound Power Boost. I think that's a phenomenal pedal. There's various versions of that.
Are you using an original one? Because it's one of the biggest pedals on the rig that I'm seeing right now.
It is, yeah. It's not an original 60s one, but I've spoken to Mr. Macari, who got all his old circuits out, and he's actually built us several to a specific circuit.
Wow.
Which is, it's a very clean, it's a lot cleaner than the ones that you can buy now. You get more headroom, and it's more for tone rather than drive. I find it a little easier to get drive out of multitude of pedals, but to get a really good clean boost signal, then there's just something about those pedals. They just have a character and a tone, the way they respond and everything. To you can really feel it in your fingers. But yeah, that's, and obviously David Gilmour used that for many years.
Yeah.
A MXR Dynacomp, a Script logo. I'd say that's very much a go-to compressor for a lot of the Gilmour stuff.
That was a staple of his board for quite some time as well, I think. Rightly, always remember seeing that was the, for me, especially when I started getting into playing guitar, that was the one. Oh, you got to have an MXR compressor. Rightly or wrongly, I don't know if that was what was used on Another Brick in the Wall, but that's the one that always stands out because it's got that kind of feel to it. But whether he actually used it on that track or not, I don't know.
I think he may have that in a CP9, Ibanez CP9.
Right.
Compressor limiter, I think one into the other. I believe so. I'm probably wrong, but Bjorn, ask
Bjorn.
We'll
have to ask the internet on that one.
Big muffs. You've really got to have big muffs for David Gilmour sounds. And I use two of them. I use the Sovtek Civil War, which is a bit more for the moderner stuff. And for the earlier stuff, it's the Electro-Harmonics, like the Pi, or the three knob. job in the Big Tin. So yeah, fuzz, you've got to have a bit of fuzz. And delays, you really can't play Pink Floyd without delays. And again, it's like a Binson Ekerek is the go to.
I can see at the moment you've got a Strymon Volante on your home board. So I'm guessing that must have been a sort of an instant purchase. When you saw that, you're like, oh, that's got to be as close to a Binson as you're going to get.
I only bought that a couple of months ago.
Okay.
And I'm absolutely blown away by it. It's, not only does it sound fantastic and authentic, but when you put your guitar through it and then plug it into your amps, it talks to the amps beautifully. It's just a match made in heaven. The tone instantly improved in the whole rig just by running it through that. Mm-hmm. It's doing something clever with the impedance, but it just works with the amps I'm using. So I was really, really doubly happy with that. But other than that, I've used the Catlin Bread and also a PCM70, Lexicon PCM70. Which is, that's a 70s effect, but has six different voices, so like six delays in one box. And David Gilmour used that in his, Momentary Lapse and Division Bell racks for his time solo. It's got like a circular delay in it effect, which is very Binson Ekerek-ish.
Right.
So that's, is that five or is that six?
Around five. So I guess for me, and just one other question on that that thing, Pete Cornish, obviously top of the boutique food chain, I think for some, I've owned a lot of gear, but probably nowhere close to what you've had, but never owned a Pete Cornish pedal. So is there a particular one that you obviously you say you need quite a few of them for the Gilmour sound, but is there one to go for?
Again, they all do different things, but for a fuzz, I've got a P1 and a P2. The P1, that's kind of what David used in the earlier, Dark Side Up to Animals type thing. P2 came along at the Momentary Lapse of Reason. It's thicker in the mids. But I really like the anger and angst that a P1 gives. And then Pete does these pedals. It was like an SS2, which is a soft sustain 2. And it's a gorgeous way of getting a bit of grit and a bit of sort of a bit more sustain, obviously, into the chain. But the thing about Pete's pedals is that when you move the knobs, they're just so accurate and precise. They're like a tool or a almost like a piece of test equipment or something. They're just so accurate and controlled, and they've got the character of their own. You might get other pedals which are more might have their own bit more of mojo or stuff, kind of almost being out of control-ish, whereas the Pete stuff is very refined, but they're almost like tools, like a Swiss Army knife set of tools. And if you're trying to shape a sound, you end up thinking, oh, I need to use one of those and one of those and this and that, because they're like the ingredients of the sound, almost like baking a cake or something.
Yeah.
They all have their own purpose, but they're also just precise. You need to own them and use them, I think, to really understand that, because they just behave differently to any other pedals.
And I guess lastly, is there anything you think you're missing? Have you ever done the last tour and gone, I just really need to get one of those?
All the time. And I'm always trying to convince my wife that I need to buy more gear as well. But,
it's part of the job, at least.
It is. You're right. And it's tax deductible, of course. Yeah, you can. But no, it's there's always, you know, you're always questing for something, and there's always something new that comes out, or you see on eBay and you see that pedal and you think, oh, and that's, you know, love to get it. But when do you stop? You know, it's I've got boxes of pedals that I've bought for trial and error, and again and again you try it and try it, and you think, you know what, the one I was already using just sounds right. You know, it just works.
I think we've all been there. Yeah. It's the worst. You cycle through your whole rig. You build. I'm in the process of building another pedal board now, and then you just you get to the end of it and go, I was probably happier with it the first time round.
Well, it is called gear acquisition syndrome for a reason, and it is something we all suffer from. And in fact, you know, I guess it's the main reason behind this podcast as well. But yes, I think we're that's about all the time we've got for this week's episode of the Friday Special. So it's been absolutely wonderful having you on the podcast, Steve. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it. It's nice to talk to people.
Yes, that's it. Yeah,
and about pedals as well, which is, like I said, I think most other tribute bands, you probably couldn't get away with talking about gear as much as you can Pink Floyd.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely chose probably the most expensive band to be a tribute band for. That's for sure.
We often do think that. Why didn't you do AC/DC?
Yeah,
absolutely.
At least you don't have to wear a schoolboy outfit every day, every evening. No, that's really fair enough.
Thanks very much for coming on, Steve. It's been great to talk to you. It's been a really eye-opening and really interesting, and for our listeners as well. So thank you very much indeed. You can, of course, catch more Guitar Nerds over on our Patreon at patreon.com/guitar nerds, or you can join us on any of the major social platforms with @guitar nerds. And we'll be back next week with our regular episode on Wednesday and another Friday special, surprisingly, on Friday. We'll catch you then for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Cheers.